not even the US, the Afghan government isn't even aware of who is making up the numbers in their units. Whereas with their conventional forces, all the units are paid through a an electronic system, which is backed up by biometric data, which none of the members of these units have to undertake. You mentioned the risk to journalists here. It's been something that has come about in particularly in recent months. In Kabul and other provincial capitals,
you've
seen a big increase in targeted attacks, many of which are targeting journalists and human rights activists.
Well, Andrew Quilty, we want you to stay safe. Thank you so much. Australian photojournalist based in Afghanistan. We'll link to your Intercept expose at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Wear a mask. Stay safe.
Supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Have you gotten your flu shot? It's never too late to protect yourself, your family, and your community against the flu. This year, it is more important than ever. Black and African Americans, people of color, pregnant people, people without health insurance or a regular health care provider, people with pre-existing conditions like asthma, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease, and people 65 and older are encouraged to get a flu shot. Multnomah County Health Department and Portland Community College are hosting a free weekly drive-through flu vaccine and COVID-19 testing clinic that will be held every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. until March 31, 2021, at PCC's Cascade Campus Parking Lot 1, located at 701 North Jessup Street in Portland. Entrance is on North Albina Street. You can drive through, bike through, or walk up to. To reserve an appointment for a flu shot or COVID test, call 503-988-8939. That's 503-988-8939. This campaign is a project of the Racial and Ethnic Approaches to Community Health and the Communicable Disease Services programs. It is made possible with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Public Service Announcements.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon legislature is considering four bills during Monday's special session. Oregon and Washington are expecting 40% fewer vaccines than they were originally promised, and the fund to provide support to Black Oregonians has been put on hold due to a lawsuit. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 18th, 2020. I'm Nat Moon. In a morning vote on Thursday, the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners voted to extend the moratorium on rental evictions until July of 2021. The vote was taken in advance of Monday's special Oregon legislative session and ensures that county renters can remain in their homes regardless of how the vote goes in Salem. In addition to protection from eviction, renters will have until early January of 2022 to catch up on their back rent. This marks the fourth time since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic that the commissioners have extended the moratorium. In a statement, County Chair Deborah Kafuri said, quote, "Multnomah County renters can rest assured that, at the very least, no matter what the state does or doesn't do, they will be protected from eviction in the new year." In addition to humanitarian concerns, commissioners were also responding to health experts who were concerned that eviction could increase the spread of the virus. Evictions could result in sharing tight quarters with family and friends in overcrowded shelters or on the street. The county board also agreed to vote on a decision to allocate $2.5 million from the Federal CARES Act to the Joint Office of Homeless Services. Oregon Governor Kate Brown has extended the state of emergency due to the ongoing coronavirus pandemic until March 3, 2021. When extending her order, Brown said, quote, "As we near 100,000 cases of COVID-19 in Oregon, and with hospitals and healthcare workers stretched to their limits, there is no doubt that the virus continues to pose a public health threat." She urged Oregonians to continue to wear masks and maintain social distancing. The extension maintains the risk-based county guidelines and mandated closures throughout the state. Earlier this week, it was announced that 29 counties are now categorized as being in the extreme risk level, including Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas. A county's risk level determines what businesses and activities are closed or restricted, whether restaurants can serve customers inside or outside, and it designates how many people can shop in stores, attend church services, or gather socially with people from other households. Each executive order for the state of emergency has lasted 60 days and is reviewed as each deadline draws near. With the state receiving its first batch of recently FDA-approved doses of COVID-19 vaccine this week, Brown noted that hope is on the horizon despite grim statistics continuing to grow. The Oregon Health Authority announced on Wednesday evening that the state will be receiving roughly 40% fewer doses of the newly approved Pfizer vaccine than originally expected. Next week's vaccine shipments were to contain nearly 41,000 doses, but the health authority is now saying those numbers have dropped to just 25,000 doses. OHA says that federal officials notified them about the change on Wednesday, but did not provide any further explanation as to why the change was made. Jonathan Modi, OHA spokesman, said, quote, "We get what we get from the federal government, but we're constantly advocating for more." Oregon Governor Kate Brown addressed the issue on Wednesday afternoon, saying, "This was a federal decision, and I am seeking answers from the CDC about the reliability of the data we are receiving from week to week as Oregon builds our vaccine distribution plan. We need accurate information to make sure Oregonians are receiving COVID-19 vaccinations as quickly as possible." Brown's comments followed Washington State Governor Jay Inslee's earlier statement on Wednesday, saying that the CDC was also shaving Washington's vaccine shipments by 40%. Inslee called the supply reduction disruptive and frustrating and said that accurate and predictable numbers are needed by local governments to ensure efficient distribution of the vaccine. The Trump administration blamed the reduction on production problems at Pfizer, the vaccine's manufacturer. But Pfizer quickly denied those accusations, saying that millions of doses were ready, but further shipment instructions had yet to be received from the federal government. In addition to the Pfizer vaccine, Oregon is expecting to receive shipments of the Moderna vaccine, which is likely to be approved within the next few days. An FDA panel gave initial approval of the vaccine for emergency use on Thursday evening. The health authority says that following the approval of the Moderna vaccine, its goal is to provide more than 100,000 healthcare workers and long-term care facility residents with first doses of the vaccine by the end of the month. Yesterday, Oregon legislative leadership met to consider four separate bills for the special session on December 21st. This is the third such session of the year necessitated by the ongoing pandemic. One of the bills is the extension of a statewide moratorium on residential evictions. The bill would create a landlord compensation fund up to $150 million and a rental assistance fund of $50 million for tenants. Another bill would allow the sale of to-go cocktails in sealed containers. That bill would allow the sales to continue until 60 days after the governor declares the end of the pandemic emergency. A third bill would provide limited liability from pandemic-based lawsuits for public schools and other educational institutions as long as they have followed the state's COVID-19 guidelines. And the fourth bill is a bill that would allocate $600 million to the state emergency fund. It would include $400 million for pandemic-related expenses and $100 million for expenses related to the Labor Day wildfires earlier this year. Special sessions are rare in Oregon, and to have three in the same year is unheard of. Before this year, the most recent special session occurred on December 14, 2012, to consider a tax break requested to retain the world headquarters of sportswear giant Nike in Beaverton. A legal challenge has halted the distribution of funds to Black Oregonians. The Oregon Cares Fund has stopped allocating grants and placed nearly $9 million of its remaining funds with a federal court, pending the result of a legal challenge. In July, the Oregon Legislature's Emergency Board voted to start the fund with federal stimulus dollars. At that time, the fund was provided with $62 million specifically for Black Oregonians, Black-owned businesses, and Black-led nonprofits. But a group of plaintiffs contend that the fund has violated the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution by distributing the benefits on the basis of race. The plaintiffs had asked U.S. Judge Karen Immergut to issue a preliminary injunction to prevent further distribution of the funds, but the Oregon Cares Fund volunteered to turn over its remaining reserves until the legal issue could be decided. The fund has already approved nearly $50 million in payments and distributed over $38 million. A lawyer for the nonprofit administering the fund said that there are still about 7,000 applications pending. In a statement yesterday, fund organizers said, quote, "We will make the case that supporting Black Oregonians does not automatically mean that everyone else is harmed. That idea is only perpetuating the problem of race in America today." It looks unlikely that the legal questions can be decided before the end of the year. Federal coronavirus relief money must be used to cover expenses incurred during 2020, and there is a concern that if the funds aren't distributed by then, they could be reclaimed by the federal government. Last month, Oregon Governor Kate Brown and Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum issued a joint statement promising to defend the fund. Last week, a group of prominent Oregon business groups also issued a statement in support. Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt said he won't wait until February to begin implementing Measure 110. Schmidt's office announced on Thursday that it'll begin treating small quantity drug possession cases as a public health matter rather than a criminal one. But in a statement, Schmidt said, quote, "Past punitive drug policies and laws resulted in over-policing of diverse communities, heavy reliance on correctional facilities, and a failure to promote public safety and health. The measure changes state law to decriminalize possession of all drugs in personal amounts. The measure was approved by over 74% of Multnomah County voters, prompting the district attorney to adopt the new policies early. Schmidt says it is time to expand access to treatment and focus limited law enforcement resources on high-level commercial drug offenses. Under the new policies, Multnomah County prosecutors will refer new criminal drug possession cases back to officers, who will then issue a revised ticket to the person charged. Pending felony cases will be downgraded, and in cases where a person has already been sentenced, a defense attorney could file a motion to downgrade convictions from a Class C felony to a Class A misdemeanor. Schmidt's office noted that Measure 110 does not decriminalize the manufacture or sale of drugs or the possession of large amounts of drugs. Commercial drug offenses will still be prosecuted and issued as a felony crime. Oregon is the first state in the nation to reject charging drug users with criminal offenses for possession of small quantities of drugs. On Wednesday, Metro Council President Lynn Peterson suggested that the transportation measure that failed to pass last month will stay on the back burner until 2022. The $7 billion measure would have funded long overdue transportation investments on roads such as TV Highway, 82nd Avenue, and McLaughlin Boulevard. Without providing any further details about a potential revival of the transportation measure in 2 years, Peterson said, quote, "This region has been waiting for this conversation for 4 decades. We all know that doing nothing is not an option." Last month, 57% of Portland area voters voted no on the measure. Opposition towards the transportation measure was aided by a multi-million dollar campaign funded by companies like Nike. The measure would have placed a tax of up to 0.75% on the payroll of employers starting in 2022, excluding local governments and businesses with 25 or fewer employees. The Portland Business Alliance argued that taxing employers would hurt businesses during a pandemic and pushed for postponing the measure. Metro officials responded to these concerns by saying the measure would create thousands of jobs over many years. Recently, Portland Business Alliance President and CEO Andrew Hone said, quote, "Because of the rush to the ballot, regional transportation planning and investment will be set back for years to come." Mayor Ted Wheeler and Portland business leaders have been begging visitors to come back downtown for months. But according to Willamette Week, the city isn't doing much to support one of its unique attractions. Portland's iconic food carts have long been enjoyed by both locals and visitors, and the cluster of 24 carts that used to be located between Southwest 9th and 10th Avenues and Alder and Washington Streets was one of the oldest and biggest concentrations of food carts in the city. But in June of 2019, the carts were displaced to make way for a 35-story Ritz-Carlton. And despite the fact that food carts are one of the few dining options that haven't been crushed by the pandemic, they've been homeless ever since. According to Keith Jones, director of the nonprofit Friends of the Green Loop, the plan was to relocate the food cart pod to the streets surrounding Ankeny Square Park. All that was required were permits from Portland Parks and Recreation and the Portland Bureau of Transportation. Initially, Jones thought the reopening was only a few weeks away, but 18 months later, the permits have still not been issued. He told Willamette Week, quote, "I'm hearing this cry for help from downtown, and we've got this great thing that is ready to go, but we just can't get the permits." According to a spokesperson for the Transportation Department, relocation of the cart pod would require the closure of one of the streets to vehicle traffic, and state law requires a lengthy public input process before such a step can be taken. Jones believes that the Transportation Department is in favor of the project, pointing out that since March, the agency has required him to carry insurance for proposed cart pod sites, even though it's currently closed to the public and fenced in. According to Marshall Runkel, Commissioner Chloe Daly's chief of staff, lessons have been learned during the drawn-out process. Runkel said, quote, "We have to be a lot more nimble, and we have to make our actions match our words. Our odds of overcoming the challenges we'll face in the future go way up when we stop thinking bureaucratically and start thinking creatively." You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Coming up next, at 5:30, it's Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sana Lee. Then at 7, The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight, we can expect rain overnight with temperatures in the high 40s. Tomorrow, we can look forward to more of the same with a mostly rainy day and the temperatures hovering around 50 degrees. On this day in 1865, the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was adopted. The amendment abolished slavery and indentured servitude. Today's quote is from activist, academic, and author Angela Davis. When asked about the impact of the amendment, Davis said, quote, "Well, for one, the 13th Amendment to the Constitution of the U.S., which abolished slavery, did not abolish slavery for those convicted of a crime." ¶¶ California Teachers Union wants local school districts to decide when to reopen schools. For more on that, here's Suzanne Potter with the Public News Service.
Teachers unions want to see significant changes to a proposal they say would force schools in California to reopen in March as long as they're out of the purple tier or most stringent level of COVID-19 restrictions. Assembly Bill 10 will be taken up as an emergency measure when the California legislature returns in January. California Federation of Teachers President Jeff Freitas wrote to state legislative leaders this week to oppose what he describes as a blanket mandate to reopen.
The one line that we don't want to cross is to remove that authority of local control. Our school boards, our parents, our educators should have the rights, the control, and the data to make the decisions for themselves.
The letter notes that teachers want to return to class, but worry it may not be safe. It calls on California to establish a statewide tracking system for outbreaks at schools as they reopen. They also point out that AB 10 contains no benchmarks for things like testing and contact tracing in schools. Casey Carlson, a special education teacher who serves as president of the Greater Santa Cruz Federation of Teachers, believes AB 10 fails to address many important issues.
Funding is needed for adequate PPE. Funding is needed for safe ventilation in school buildings and for extra intervention that might be needed for students who have to catch up.
The bill is sponsored by several prominent Democrats in the legislature. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Atlantic City, New Jersey is auctioning off the rights to blow up the derelict Trump Plaza Casino, with proceeds benefiting the local Boys and Girls Club. The casino was first opened in 1984 and was permanently closed in 2014. The Trump Casino's facade is starting to crumble, and the city has designated it a safety hazard. Atlantic City Mayor Marty Small said that he's hoping the high bid will exceed $1 million, and based on early bidding, it appears there's a good chance to go well past that number. Demolition is set for January 29th, and the latest high bid is already close to $900,000. Congress may have to go into overtime to complete a new stimulus deal, and for the first time, a Native American could be the next Interior Secretary. With more on those stories, it's Mary Sherman with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
When it comes to unemployment benefits, stimulus checks, aid to small businesses, and so much else, we have a responsibility to get this right. People's lives depend upon it.
Congressional leaders are expected to work into the weekend to finalize a deal on a second COVID relief package. Thursday, Senate Minority Leader Democrat Chuck Schumer called out Republicans for stalling.
Had the Republican majority joined in negotiations any time in the last 6 months as we had requested, we would not be in the unfortunate position of negotiating against the government funding deadline.
President-elect Joe Biden has nominated perhaps his most diverse cabinet pick yet, New Mexico Congresswoman Deb Haaland as Secretary of the Interior. She would be the first Native American to lead the department and will offer a fresh perspective.
Somebody that is steeped into the issues and knows a lot of the ins and outs of what this administration has done to undermine the protections for our public lands and really allow the fossil fuel industry to run roughshod over those lands for the last 4 years.
Director of the Western Values Project, Jason O'Neill, adds that it's a milestone moment for Native Americans.
And our first people on this land who have lived in unison with it for thousands of generations, to have that perspective is something that so many communities haven't had, and it's going to empower them to do good things.
Biden is expected to name Michael Reagan to run the Environmental Protection Agency. Reagan is currently head of the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality. If approved, he would be the second African-American to lead the agency. But top Senate Republicans have signaled resistance to Biden's nominees, if only for what they see as payback.
I don't want retaliation for its own sake, but the threat of holding Democrat senators to their own standards has been our only means of deterrence. Of obstruction.
Republican Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa is referring to the Senate Democrat minority that blocked President Donald Trump from assembling his cabinet quickly after his inauguration. Democrats could be forgiven for pointing out that Senate Republicans blocked hundreds of President Obama's judicial and other appointments, and that delays for many of Trump's nominees were because the nominations were presented prematurely, without the standard background checks and other paperwork ready to go. In Georgia, Vice President Mike Pence stumped for two Republicans in the state's Senate runoff election. Countering Trump's inspired fears of voter fraud, Pence encouraged Republicans to cast their ballots.
I hear some people saying down here in Georgia, if you're frustrated about the last election, just don't vote. But my fellow Americans, I say from my heart, you got to remember, if you don't vote, they win.
And President-elect Joe Biden formally responded to reports of a months-long cyber attack targeting government agencies and private sector companies. He promised that his administration will be tough on those who engage in cyber attacks and focus on disrupting adversaries to deter from such attacks in the first place. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
Native Americans celebrated the nomination of Representative Deb Haaland to Interior Secretary, and a University of Oregon professor was recognized for his book on Cherokee history. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. People across Indian country celebrated the announcement Thursday President-elect Joe Biden intends to nominate Congresswoman Deb Haaland, Laguna Pueblo, for Secretary of the Department of the Interior.
It's really monumental, and I'm super excited. My family is, my daughter, my son. We're all excited, and we're rooting for her.
Ruth Buffalo says Haaland has been a solid supporter for Native people, making a difference in Congress, and if confirmed to lead the Interior Department, she sees Haaland doing the same. Buffalo, a citizen of the Mandan, Hidatsa, Arikara Nation, is the only Indigenous woman serving in North Dakota's legislature. Buffalo made history in 2018, elected as the first Native Democratic woman to the State House. The same year, Haaland, along with Sharice Davids Ho-Chunk, were elected as the first two Native women in Congress. Buffalo says it's hard to express the magnitude of what it would mean to have a Native woman lead the Interior Department.
I foresee a huge ripple effect, and it's just kind of showing what is yet to come. Think of all the young girls. I remember there was a quote that, our young daughters are not going to know anything different than having representation at the highest level of government, at the federal level. And rather than having to try to train or, spend so much conversations and time to sway hearts and minds, we will have that strong voice that is rooted in peace and dignity and love, and also understanding that strong inherent connection that we have to the land.
Buffalo says news of Haaland is providing hope as tribal nations across the country are hit hard by COVID-19. Similar sentiments of positivity are being echoed by tribal leaders, including in Haaland's home state of New Mexico. Brian Vio is governor of Acoma Pueblo.
I believe it sends a very strong message that representation of the Native American people in this system, in this government, is very crucial and timely, and I hope that this appointment will be confirmed and that it sets a very strong precedent for the role of Native American people in federal government.
Bio is hopeful for a more robust government-to-government relationship and the agency tasked with Indian affairs to carry out trust responsibilities and land resource management. Other Pueblo governors and Navajo and Apache leaders in New Mexico are also backing Haaland. In a statement, Haaland said she's incredibly honored to accept the nomination and ready to serve. A University of Oregon professor has been recognized by a global organization for his book on the dark age of Cherokee history. KLCC's Brian Bull has more.
The Modern Language Association announced its latest MLA Prize for Studies in Native American Literatures, Cultures, and Languages. An honorable mention went to Kirby Brown, an associate professor of Native American Literature at the U of O and citizen of the Cherokee Nation. Brown's work, titled Stoking the Fire, Nationhood and Cherokee Writing, presents written works following the establishment of Oklahoma as a state in 1907, whereupon many aspects of the Cherokee Nation were dissolved, including its government.
Most scholars just view it as this empty period where there wasn't a whole lot happening and there wasn't a solid sense of Cherokee nationhood. When I got into the actual literature from this period that Cherokees are producing, I saw how radically wrong that was, that nationhood is all over the place.
In 1970, legislation helped tribes reclaim their government, including the Cherokee. Brown congratulates MLA winner Christopher Pexa, a University of Minnesota professor, for his book, Translate a Nation, Rewriting the Dakota Oyate. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 18th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Jeffrey Wade, Claire Rosciotto, and Ray Bodwell. The producer is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Suzanne Potter, Mary Sherman, Antonia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lazowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Nat Moon. Stay safe, wear a mask.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson.